This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, the Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion Dollar Franchise by Chris Taylor. Performed by Nick Podell. Introduction. A Navajo Hope. George James Sr. was 88 years old when I met him in July 2013. But in the crimson of a setting desert sun, he seemed almost timeless. He wore a white Stetson and had leathery skin, a thin build, and deep-set coal-black eyes. He stooped a little from the shrapnel that has been in his back since 1945. James is Totsoni, part of the Big Water clan of the Navajo people, and was born where he still lives, in the mountains near Salley, Arizona. When he was 17, James was drafted and became that rarest of World War II veterans, a code talker. He was one of five code talkers who stormed the beaches of Iwo Jima and transmitted more than 800 vital messages back and forth between the island and the offshore command post in their native language. Their code was virtually unbreakable because there were then fewer than 30 non-native speakers of Navajo in the entire world. For an encore, the 165-pound James helped save an unconscious fellow private's life by carrying his 200-pound frame across the black sands of Iwo and into a foxhole. His calmness under fire helped determine the course of the horrific battle, and arguably, the war. "Were it not for the Navajo," said a major in George's division, "the Marines would never have taken Iwo Jima." James's wartime story was enough to make my jaw hit the floor when I met him. But there was something else about him that was almost as incredible. George James was the first person I'd met in a year of searching who seemed to genuinely not know the first thing about the movie we were about to watch. Something called Star Wars. "When I heard the title, I thought, 'The stars are at war?'" James said, and shrugged. "I don't go to the movies." There haven't been any movie theaters here in Window Rock, Arizona, the sun-bleached capital of the Navajo Nation, since the last one closed in 2005. Window Rock is a one-stoplight town with a McDonald's, a dollar store, a couple of hotels, the eponymous natural stone arch, and a statue honoring the code talkers. There are plenty of screens here, but they're all personal. Teens thumb through smartphones in parking lots. There are iPads and TVs and Wi-Fi in Window Rock, just as in any 21st century Western town. But there's no large public screen where the people, they're called Diné, Navajo, or just the people, can get together and share a projected dream. But for one night in 2013, that changed. On July 3rd, the first movie ever dubbed into a Native American tongue was screened at the rodeo grounds on a giant screen bolted to the side of a 10-wheeler truck. Just outside of town on Highway 49 sat the only poster advertising this historic event on a wilderness billboard that for a time became the hottest roadside attraction on the Arizona-New Mexico border. Star Wars, Episode 4, A New Hope, translated into the Navajo language, it said, alongside a 1977 poster for the movie. I must have seen that Star Wars poster a million times, but on this highway from Gallup, out of my element and surrounded by brush-covered mesas, I could almost make myself see it through fresh eyes. The kid in white robes appears to be holding some sort of flashlight to the sky. A young woman in strange hair buns holds a gun and poses by his side. Behind them looms a giant gas mask face with dead eyes and a samurai helmet. What a strange dream this movie must be. Just inside town is the Navajo Nation Museum, which spent the past 3 years persuading Lucasfilm to collaborate on this adaptation of Star Wars. I had to wonder why they persisted so long instead of choosing another translation project. And then I walked into the office of the museum director, Manuelito Wheeler, and saw a shelf full of Boba Fett figurines taking pride of place. Manny, as he is known, is a big bear of a guy with a stoic expression and silver flecks in his black ponytail hair. A more relaxed and unpretentious museum director you could never hope to meet. He called me dude from our first phone call. He told me he'd loved the original trilogy ever since he caught it on VHS in his late 20s. He can more than hold his own in the traditional geek bonding ritual of quoting Star Wars lines. When I was running late for a subsequent meeting with him, we texted each other Death Star Trench Run dialogue. Stay on target. I can't maneuver. Stay on target. Wheeler could wax lyrical about the purpose of the screening, which the museum had conceived of as a way to nurture and preserve the Navajo language. But he also understood that in order for that campaign to be most effective, these matters needed to be approached the same way that Star Wars itself begs to be approached, with exuberance and lightness. Not that the need to preserve the Navajo language is not dire. The people's mother tongue, also known as Diné, is dying. Fewer than half of the 300,000 people of the nation can speak it at all. Fewer than 100,000 are fluent. Fewer than 1 in 10 can read Diné. Back in George James's day, kids were taught English in reservation schools and spoke Diné at home. These days, Diné is taught in schools, but kids of the 21st century don't care to learn it. Why bother when English fills their smartphones, tablets, and TVs? We're know-it-alls now, Wheeler sighed. We need to reinvent ourselves. What the next generation of Diné needed, he figured, was exactly what George Lucas felt the youth of the 1970s needed. Adventure, thrills, good versus bad, a fairy tale utterly divorced in space and time from the here and now, yet also grounded in familiar themes and myths. The story Lucas labored over for years was in many senses a product of its time and the eras that had preceded it, but the dream he captured on celluloid turned out to be utterly malleable and exportable. Star Wars might just have the power to make Diné cool again. But isn't this just a form of American cultural imperialism in which native people are surrendering to the forces of Hollywood? Wheeler has two words for that notion. Come on, dude! Star Wars is not Hollywood. It is the brainchild of a staunchly independent, Hollywood-hating filmmaker in Marin County who recruited a bunch of young countercultural visual effects guys in a Van Nuys warehouse. The villain of this fairy tale, the Empire, was inspired by the U.S. military in Vietnam, the Ewoks by the Viet Cong, the Emperor by President Nixon. The fairy tale was charmingly benign enough to mask that fact, and now every culture around the planet, whether embattled or entitled, sees itself in the Rebel Alliance. But the subversive story was there from the moment Lucas sat down to write his first draft. Star Wars has got a very, very elaborate social, emotional, political context that it rests in, Lucas said in 2012. But of course, nobody was aware of that. And there's another reason for the Navajo to embrace Star Wars more than most cultures. There's something spiritual going on here, Wheeler says. He points out that Joseph Campbell, the giant of global mythology, steeped himself in Navajo culture. That was the subject of Campbell's first book, Where the Two Came to Their Father, 1943, published 3 years before The Hero with a Thousand Faces. If George Lucas was as influenced by that book as he claims, Manny says, then Star Wars in Navajo brings it full circle. I asked Wheeler what the elders, seniors are highly esteemed in Diné culture, would think of the movie. He raised a finger, pulled out his iPhone, and showed me pictures from the cast and crew screening, a more intimate affair to which he had invited 100 elders. He swiped through pictures of old women in bright azure and red dresses. It's a matriarchal culture, he said. So when Princess Leia comes on the screen and is this powerful figure, they get it. Wheeler grinned and pointed to his grandmother. And she really digs Obi-Wan. I was thrilled for Wheeler's grandmother, but my disappointment was palpable. He wasn't to know, But by inviting the elders to the private screening for the cast, he had all but torpedoed my last real hope of finding someone, anyone, who was a true Star Wars innocent. The road that had taken me to Window Rock began just before the 35th birthday of Star Wars in 2012. During a meeting to plan coverage of this milestone at Mashable, the website where I work, it was discovered that one of our own, features writer Christine Erickson, had somehow never seen Star Wars. Our immediate reaction, how had she survived this long? All her life, Christine had heard incomprehensible phrases like, "May the Force be with you," and, "These are not the droids you're looking for." Recalled Christine, "I used to have to just ask people what they were talking about." Her friend's reaction always fell on a spectrum, somewhere between scoffing and laughing. A familiarity with Star Wars, or at least the 1977 film of the franchise which has spawned enough sequels, prequels, TV adaptions, and other spin-offs to boggle the mind and to justify the book you are now listening to, is the sine qua non of our modern media-drenched global culture. Shame and scorn is the very least that anyone like Christine can expect. "I've had people say to me, 'We can't be friends anymore,'" says Natalia Kokan, a graduate student who somehow managed to miss the movie despite attending George Lucas's alma mater, the University of Southern California. "I began to notice how Star Wars saturated modern life is. References crop up in the oddest places. I went to a yoga class. The teacher's shorthand for the technique of Ujjayi breathing was, 'Just breathe like Darth Vader.' I went to Facebook for a press briefing on the algorithm that governs what stories we see in our news feeds. The executive explained it by showing how Yoda would see different posts from Luke Skywalker compared to the posts Darth Vader and Princess Leia would see on their feeds because of the different familial relationships." Nobody in the room batted an eyelid. Star Wars had become the one movie series for which it is always perfectly acceptable in modern society to discuss spoilers. Vader, by the way, is Luke Skywalker's dad. Perhaps this is to be expected at Facebook HQ. Its founder, Mark Zuckerberg, was enough of a nerd to have had his bar mitzvah Star Wars themed. But you need only peruse those news feeds to see how frequently Star Wars memes and references permeate social media. At the time of this recording, the original movie has been liked by 268 million Facebook users. Or if you want to be more old school about it, just turn on the TV. It almost doesn't matter which channel. 30 Rock, Archer, Big Bang Theory, Bones, Community, The Daily Show, Everybody Loves Raymond, Family Guy, Friends, The Goldbergs, House, Ink Master, Just Shoot Me, King of the Hill, Lost, Mythbusters, News Radio, The Office, The Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, South Park, Scrubs, That 70s Show. All these shows and more have casually tossed around Star Wars references, written Star Wars-based plot lines, or produced special Star Wars episodes. The popular 9-year-old sitcom How I Met Your Mother spoke for whole generations in its obsession with the original Star Wars trilogy. The show's hero learns never to date a woman who hasn't seen it. The show's Lothario keeps a stormtrooper costume center stage in his apartment. There was a time between the trilogies when Star Wars lived on the geeky fringes of society. No longer. Now, it seems, society is telling us that Star Wars gets you laid and mated. Star Wars is every bit as important elsewhere in the world as it is in America. In the United Kingdom, there's a popular TV and radio reality show on which guests are asked to perform some activity that they have to shamefully admit they've never done. The title is Never Seen Star Wars. Japan is particularly Star Wars crazy. In Tokyo, I met an American who'd moved to the country to be with his boyfriend and was still met years later with near constant mockery by the boyfriend's traditional Japanese parents. Not for his sexual orientation, but because the poor guy had never seen Star Wars. "They keep quoting lines of dialogue at me," he complained. We at Mashable couldn't allow this state of ignorance and shame to continue for one of our own. Plans were made for a live blog, We'd show Christine the original movie. She'd tweet about it. We'd all chime in. The Twitter hashtag for the event was #StarWarsVirgin. Mashable's community was abuzz. What is Star Wars like through fresh eyes? Would Christine be blown away? Could we capture the elusive spirit of 1977 just for a moment? Well, not exactly. Christine got wrapped up in the action, to be sure, but, well, so much of it seemed oddly familiar. Every big-budget special effects movie since Star Wars has employed elements from the original film. So many that they are now all recognizable tropes. For example, the used universe, that style of making technology and futuristic costumes look real and dirty and lived in, was a Star Wars innovation. Practically every science fiction movie since the early 1980s has borrowed it, from Blade Runner and Mad Max on down. Nor have Star Wars virgins been sheltered from the world of advertising, which contains a burgeoning number of Star Wars homages. Verizon produced a Halloween ad in 2013 in which entire families dress as Star Wars characters, and the fact goes unmentioned because doesn't everyone? Christine's response on seeing the droids R2-D2 and C-3PO for the first time, "Oh, so that's where the smartphone comes from." Verizon and Google licensed the name Droid from Lucasfilm. She recognized R2-D2 as a Pepsi cooler that used to live by the bleachers at high school. Darth Vader? Christine knew that costume. It was the one worn by that kid in the 2011 Volkswagen Super Bowl commercial. And yes, even she knew Vader was Luke's dad already. Every supposed Star Wars virgin has actually picked up an extraordinary number of spoilers in their lives. This was my hypothesis. I decided to test it in a larger experiment. For May the 4th, Star Wars Day, an event first suggested by a British MP's pun on May the Force in 1979, but really came into its own as a holiday for the first time in 2013, Mashable asked Lucasfilm and the petition website Change.org to collaborate on a screening of the original movie for #StarWarsNewbies. Virgin, we decided, was too much of a hot-button word, held at the Change.org headquarters in San Francisco. The first thing we discovered was how hard it is to find anyone in the Bay Area in the 21st century who had never seen any Star Wars movies. This was, after all, ground zero for the first culture bomb. It only took until the end of 1977 before the number of people who'd bought a ticket to see Star Wars in the city exceeded its 750,000 population. Even with the combined recruitment efforts of StarWars.com, Change.org, and Mashable, we managed to unearth just 30 newbies, alongside a much larger number of friends and relatives who simply wanted to watch them watch it for the first time. Before the screening, the newbies were interviewed to determine just how much they knew. Again, they surprised us. "I know it's out of order," said Jamie Yamaguchi, 32, a mother from Oakley, California, of the set of 6 films. "I thought that was kind of strange." Her parents' strict religious code meant she'd seen few movies to begin with. The characters she knew, Princess Leia, Obi-Wan Kenobi, R2, Luke, the gold guy and that annoying guy who speaks funny. Oh, and Darth Vader. Many answers were along the lines of this also real response. "Oh, I don't really know any of the characters' names, except for Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Princess Leia, Darth Vader, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Yoda. That's all I got." "I know the big reveal," said Tammy Fisher, a teacher at UC Hastings College of the Law and a former clerk to a California Supreme Court justice, "the father-son relationship between whatever their names are." "My kids asked me if Luke and Leia knew they were brother and sister," said Yamaguchi. "I was like, they are?" It's increasingly hard to avoid Star Wars spoilers. They bombard us from birth, whether we seek them out or not. A number of parents have come up to me during the process of writing this book and asked how come their younger kids know all the names of all the characters and planets in Star Wars, and can recite the most obscure historical details behind almost every aspect of the franchise, despite the fact that those kids are too young to have seen any of the 6 movies yet. I've responded by asking either, where did Luke Skywalker come from? Or, what are those teddy bear creatures in Return of the Jedi called? When the parents answer Tatooine or Ewoks, I say, there you go. The planet was never named in the original Star Wars. Those creatures are never actually named in a Star Wars movie. You pick their names up someplace else. I found out what Tatooine was called at the age of 4 in 1978, before I saw Star Wars, when I read it on the back of a cereal box. The revelation of the Ewoks came in a 1983 book of collectible stickers, months before Return of the Jedi. How far has this benign cultural infection spread? Is there anyone on the planet not carrying a little piece of Star Wars code in their heads? We do not know how many individual people have seen a Star Wars movie in a theater, a Lucasfilm spokesperson told me, but we do know that there have been approximately 1.3 billion admissions over the 6 films worldwide. That seems a conservative estimate, and it would be equally conservative to add another billion home video viewers on top of that, judging by the $6 billion the franchise has earned in VHS and DVD sales over the years. This does not even begin to count the video store rentals or the vast market of pirated copies. How many billions more have watched it on TV, or seen an ad, or picked up one tiny piece of the $20 billion worth of Star Wars licensed merchandise that's cluttering up the planet? Or, to look at the question the other way around, how many billions or millions of people have managed to avoid every last one of these trappings of the Star Wars franchise? And just who are these people? I was naive enough to think I could just come to somewhere like Window Rock and catch wide-eyed innocents watching Star Wars for the first time. But that hope was dashed the moment the Albuquerque and Salt Lake City garrisons of the 501st Legion, a charitably-minded bad guy Star Wars costuming organization, rolled into Window Rock after epic long drives, donned their uniforms, and marched into the rodeo grounds at sunset. They were met with rapturous applause from the packed bleachers, a welcome greater than any I'd seen the 501st get at a Comic-Con or Star Wars celebration convention. They marched in alongside the lines of viewers that had been forming for hours in 107-degree heat. A stormtrooper, a snowtrooper, a biker scout, an Imperial Guard, a bounty hunter, and of course, one Dark Lord of the Sith himself. Darth Vader was mobbed, with babies pressed into his arms while excitable mothers took pictures on iPads. I also noticed a bunch of enterprising kids selling lightsabers. They were wearing Stormtrooper t-shirts with the legend, "These aren't the Denet you're looking for." I asked Wheeler if the t-shirts were his doing, but he shrugged. He only made the sparkly Navajo Star Wars tops for the crew. He wandered off to have his picture taken with Boba Fett. "Help me, elders," I thought. "You're my only hope." And then, as the mesas turned from sunset crimson to twilight indigo, and a lightning storm started to crackle in the distance, I met George James Sr., Iwo Jima veteran and Star Wars virgin. It was as if I'd just been introduced to a unicorn leaping over a double rainbow. It had to be too good to be true. I ran through a list of names. Skywalker, Solo, Lucas, Wookiee. James shook his head at all of them, uncomprehending. I pointed out the tall guy in the black helmet, who was now dealing with a line of guys pointing and tapping their throats. They wanted to take a picture for a popular internet meme called Vadering, where you leap in the air and pretend to be force-choked by the Dark Lord. James was perplexed. He genuinely had no idea why the kids from his tribe were doing battle with glowing sticks. When Wheeler got up to introduce the local Navajo voice talent, I had to tell James that no, this is not the Mr. Lucas I had just been talking about. Then, just before the floodlights dimmed and the 20th Century Fox logo appeared on the screen, something occurred to James. He had seen something on someone's TV one time, he remembers. A clip from a movie set in space. "I saw wild birds," he says. Wild birds in space? What could that be? I think for a second. I hold my arms up and then down at 45 degrees. Like this? James nods. His eyes light up in recognition. Wild birds. X-wing fighters. Even 88-year-old George James Sr., who lives in the mountains and sleeps under sheepskin in a home so remote that it is blockaded by snow for months at a time, was carrying inside his head a piece of Star Wars code. Just like you and I and pretty much everyone else on the planet. The 20th Century Fox fanfare ended. The screen went black, and an electric cheer went up from the crowd. Familiar blue letters appeared on the screen, but this time, for the first time in history, the phrase, "A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away," was rendered in words so alien they had once been banned by the U.S. government, so unfamiliar to the rest of the planet that they were used in World War II cryptography. Ashkeda yeda hodis ada. Ya'a honakonde. That's all it took. The crowd roared so loud that I could barely hear the blast of the theme's opening chord. And Star Wars casually conquered one more Earthling culture. This book is a biography of the franchise that turned Planet Earth into Planet Star Wars. Its goals are twofold. First, to provide the first complete history of the franchise from its fantastical origins through Disney's $4.05 billion purchase in 2012 of Lucasfilm, the studio that created the movies. Second, and perhaps more interestingly, the book aims to explore the other side of the relationship, how Star Wars has affected and been affected by its planet of fans. The story of the Star Wars franchise itself shows creativity at its most powerful. It is the tale of how something titled The Journal of the Wills, a couple of pages of impenetrable Flash Gordon fanfiction scribbled in pencil and then abandoned by its creator, transmogrified into a vast universe that has sold $20 billion and counting worth of merchandise around the globe. Taking into account ticket sales, licensing, and other revenue streams, it's likely that Star Wars generated more than $37 billion between 1977 and 2013. Much of that success had to do with the hard work of a small posse of dedicated believers whose names were not George Lucas. But Star Wars has millions of extremely devoted acolytes far beyond this initial cabal. Collectors and costuming collectives. Droid builders and lightsaber lovers, spoofers and satirists. And most of these groups have, in unexpected ways, become part of the franchise itself. Even Lucas himself, at his most messianic, recognized that he was responsible for, at most, a third of what we talk about when we talk about Star Wars. I am the father of our Star Wars movie world, the filmed entertainment, the features, and the television series. He said in 2008. I set them up, and I train the people, and I go through them all. I'm the father. That's my work. Then we have the licensing group, which does the games, toys, and all that other stuff. I call that the son. And the son does pretty much what he wants. Then we have the third group, the Holy Ghost, which is the bloggers and fans. They have created their own world. I worry about the father's world. The Son and Holy Ghost can go their own way. Since Lucas spoke those words, the Father has gone his own way, too. Lucas entered retirement after the Lucasfilm sale, and while new Star Wars features are barreling toward the cineplexes of Earth, they're doing so under the watchful eye of the franchise's stepmother, veteran film producer Kathleen Kennedy. When the next Star Wars film hits the big screen, it will be the first in history to emerge without the helicopter parenting of the creator himself. This is a nickname Lucas applied to himself in 2007 after President George W. Bush famously referred to himself as the Decider. Responding to a question from Conan O'Brien about fans challenging him, Lucas pointed out that he is another George W. He told the host, "I'm more than the Decider. I am the creator." With Star Wars poised to enter a new phase in its long history, it's an appropriate moment to pause and take stock of this creation. In particular, it's worth pointing out that behind the scenes, the world of Star Wars has never been as unified as Lucas's Holy Trinity metaphor suggests. The more you fall in love with the franchise, it seems, the more you recognize how rickety its space fantasy foundations are. The greatest fans of the expanded universe, the collective name for the hundreds of Star Wars novels, thousands of Star Wars comics, and countless video games and other media that have developed characters and storylines outside of the Star Wars films themselves, are the first ones to tell you how much of it is self-contradictory and just plain sucks. And many lovers of Star Wars are intensely partisan about and protective of the films themselves. Fans of the original trilogy, episodes 4 to 6, released 1977 to 1983, have stewed obsessively over every change in Lucas's upgraded versions, tweaked for re-release in 1997, 2004, 2006, and 2011, and remain bitterly divided over the prequel trilogy, episodes 1 to 3, released 1999 to 2005. These twin passions, love and hate, are as constant companions to Star Wars fans as Jedi and Sith, or as the twin sons of Tatooine. In 2005, a 20-year-old in Vancouver called Andre Summers witnessed the deep schisms within Star Wars fandom firsthand when he attended a midnight screening of Episode 3. The screening was preceded by a costume contest, and Summers was shocked when, in the course of it, older fans actually started booing the homemade costumes of younger fans. "That's when I realized," Summers told me, "these fuckers aren't into joy. They're into canonical accuracy." He went home and penned a column for an online magazine called Jive, titling it, "The Complex and Terrifying Reality of Star Wars Fandom." Like most of Star Wars itself, it was intended half-humorously, but written in earnest. The conceit was that Summers was having a hard time explaining fandom to his girlfriend, because true fans hate everything about Star Wars, from the whiny delivery of Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker in the original trilogy, to the CGI pratfalls of Jar Jar Binks in the prequels. If you run into somebody who tells you they thought the franchise was quite enjoyable, and they very much liked the originals as well as the prequels, and even own everything on DVD, and a few of the books, these imposters are not Star Wars fans, he wrote. Jive magazine is now defunct, but Summers' column went viral, translated into multiple languages. It bounced around the internet on forum after forum. He was bombarded by emails from amused fans who got the point and angry ones who didn't. Summers was clearly onto something when he pointed out that love and hate are twin virtues of every true Star Wars fan. And though he didn't know it, his column was an echo of something that was said in the halls of Lucasfilm itself. "To make Star Wars, you've got to hate Star Wars." This is a maxim I've heard from more than one veteran of Lucasfilm's design department. What they mean is that if you're too reverential about what came before, you're doomed. You've got to be rebellious and questing. The franchise must constantly renew itself by pulling incongruous items out of a grab bag of outlined influences, as Lucas himself did from the start. Likewise, fandom must constantly renew itself with new generations of viewers brought in by the prequels, by more recent additions to the canon like The Clone Wars and Rebels animated TV shows, and, soon enough, by the sequels to the first two trilogies. Just as new fans are essential to keeping Star Wars alive and healthy, jaded old fans must renew themselves by going back to the thing that gave them joy in the first place. "To be a Star Wars fan," concluded Summers in his column, "one must possess the ability to see a million different failures and downfalls, and then somehow assemble them into a greater picture of perfection. Every true Star Wars fan is a Luke Skywalker, looking at his twisted evil father and somehow seeing good." "We hate everything about Star Wars," Summers concluded before offering a line every fan in the world could agree with, "but the idea of Star Wars, the idea we love." In Window Rock, lightning forked in the distant hills, but few in the audience seemed to notice or care. The people were cheering like crazy for the roll-up at the start of the movie. Every word of it in Dene. Once the dialogue started, there was laughter for the first 15 minutes straight. Not laughter at the film or the performances, but the joyful laugh of a people seeing a movie in their own language for the first time. To a viewer like me who had grown up watching Star Wars in its original English, a surprising moment of the movie sounded the same. Lucas loved cool sounds and sweeping music and the babble of dialogue more than he cared for dialogue itself. Much of the music is either free of speech or filled with foreign chatter from aliens and droids. Think of R2, of the Jawas. Intentionally unintelligible, and we love them for it. Think of how much time is filled with back-and-forth blaster fire or the roar of TIE fighters, actually a slowed-down elephant call, or the hum of lightsabers, a broken TV, an old projector. When I first learned that Wheeler's team of translators had been able to translate the movie from English to Navajo in just 36 hours, it had seemed a superhuman feat. In fact, there just isn't as much English in Star Wars as you might remember. Some words are untranslatable and remain in English. Princess Leia has the exact same title, since Dene contains no concept of royalty. Likewise, Imperial Senate and Rebel Alliance. The Navajo are so inherently egalitarian that the U.S. government had to force them to set up a governing body it could deal with. And while the translated dialogue is something of a melange, the translators speak three different dialects of Dene, this turns out not to matter at all. After all, it doesn't sound weird to English speakers that half of the actors in the film are British and half American. Carrie Fisher seems to be playing both accents, but we've grown to embrace that too. Humor translates differently, of course. The audience seemed to laugh at every word 3PO says. This may be partly because the droid is a drag act. Voice actress Jerry Hongiva Camarillo matches his prissy tones perfectly. Some months later, I told Anthony Daniels, the original 3PO, about this gender switch. "The Navajo must be a very confused race," he said in his best clueless 3PO voice, before winking and reminding me that concept artist Ralph McQuarrie, one of the largely unsung heroes of Star Wars, had originally envisioned Daniels's character as a waif-thin female robot. The biggest laugh of the evening, however, goes to Leia's line aboard the Death Star. "Governor Tarkin, I should have expected to find you holding Vader's leash. I recognized your foul stench when I came on board." There's a kind of earthiness to the phrase, it seems, that sounds especially hilarious in Navajo, even though Fisher found it one of the hardest lines of the movie to sell. Peter Cushing, who plays Tarkin, actually smelled of linen and lavender, she said. How strange it was to watch Star Wars in a foreign language and still get sucked in. I marveled once again at how flawlessly the story flows. Then came the CGI monsters of Mos Eisley, the shot from Greedo, the incongruous appearance of computerized Jabba, and I winced. I was reminded that in approving this adaptation, Lucasfilm had required Wheeler to use the latest, highest-quality special edition version. The movie starts to drag a little around the trash compactor scene. The kids in particular seemed distracted, preferring to play with their lightsabers in the aisles. They were caught up in the idea of Star Wars more than Star Wars itself. Families got up and left before the Death Star trench run, 11 p.m. being way past kids' bedtime. But for the hundreds who remained when the lights came up, the movie created its own little cult of celebrity, just as it has in every other culture it has ever invaded. There was a cast signing afterwards, with the main seven voice actors, and the line to meet them coiled around the stadium. The actors are all amateurs. Darth Vader, for example, was played by local sports coach Marvin Yellowhair, and had been chosen from out of 117 people who had auditioned for the roles. They had been selected for their passion in performing, not for their knowledge of Dene. It worked. Their exuberance, plus their familiarity with the subject material, carried the day. I went looking for reactions from the few elders I saw in the line. This was the closest I was ever going to get to a complete adult newbie experience of Star Wars. Every one of the elders to whom I spoke shared George James's confusion over the title. Why are the stars at war? The elders also echoed one of the main complaints that had been leveled against Star Wars in 1977. It went too fast. Modern audiences, of course, see it as too slow. The ethos of Star Wars helped beget the ethos of MTV. Some were confused about exactly what each side was fighting for. You can translate stolen data tapes into Navajo, but you can't make it make sense. Then I learned something spiritual from this group of elders. Manny was right about the Joseph Campbell connection bringing Star Wars full circle. May the Force be with you, it turns out, is a nearly literal translation of a Navajo prayer. The Force, in their usage, can best be described as a kind of positive, life-filled, extrasensory force field surrounding them. We call for strength, for protection from negativity, Thomas Deal, 82, told me via a translator. Some of the elders glimpsed their belief system in George Lucas's creation. Good was trying to conquer evil, and asking for protection in doing so, summarized Annette Bilgodi, an 89-year-old in the traditional dress of a Diné grandmother. She also offered the highest praise of the evening. I enjoyed it as much as my granddaughter did. She wasn't alone. In the months to come, Wheeler would take his translated version of the movie on the road, screening it for Native American communities at film festivals around the United States. A DVD of Star Wars in Navajo sold out multiple times in Walmarts around the Southwest. 20th Century Fox and Lucasfilm got all the money, but that didn't matter to Manny. What mattered, he said, was that the concept is blossoming. He was hearing one question constantly asked around the nation. What films should we make in Navajo next? There was even interest in building another movie theater in Window Rock. As for George James Sr., he excused himself 10 minutes into the movie and never returned. Perhaps as a veteran of Iwo Jima, he hadn't wanted to see people blasting each other with weapons modeled on World War II military sidearms. Perhaps as a code talker, he hadn't relished a story that revolves around an innocent hunted for the crime of carrying a message. But I like to think that in leaving early, James managed to preserve some of the mystery he had brought to that evening, and that he's still out there at his home in the mountains, wondering about wild birds and the stars at war. 1. Mars Wars. Clearly, Star Wars is a grand galaxy-spanning mythological epic. Except, no. Wait, it's a family-sized fairy tale in the land of far, far away. Unless it's a samurai story, or possibly a World War II-style action-adventure. Since the first film in 1977, fans and critics have contorted themselves in all sorts of directions explaining the appeal of Star Wars by reference to a dozen different genres. No one is more adept at this than George Lucas, who variously compared it to a spaghetti western, Sword and Sorcery, 2001, Lawrence of Arabia, Captain Blood, and the entire James Bond franchise. And that was all before the original movie was even filmed. Navigate past this asteroid field of influences, and what you find at the center of Star Wars is a simple, whimsical subgenre, space fantasy. Space fantasy is to its parent genre, science fiction, as Luke Skywalker is to Darth Vader. George Lucas came closer to science fiction with his first movie, THX 1138, and then abandoned it as too real, too dismal, too unpopular at the box office. Science fiction projects an image of the future through the lens of the present. The focus is on technology and its implications. There is some effort to adhere to the physical laws of the universe. It is fiction about science, whereas space fantasy is, well, fantasy set in space. Arguably, every movie Lucas ever made or had a strong hand in producing was some kind of fantasy or fantasia. American Graffiti was the latter. The genre he once offered for THX was documentary fantasy. Science fiction echoes our world. Space fantasy transcends our world. It is nostalgic and romantic, and more freely adventurous, and it takes technology as a mere starting point. It casts aside the laws of physics in favor of fun. I was afraid science fiction buffs would say things like, "You know there's no sound in space," Lucas said in 1977. I just wanted to forget science. In space, everyone can hear you go, pew pew! This great divide in speculative fiction, the possible versus the merely enjoyable, goes back to the fin de siècle rivalry between French science fiction pioneer Jules Verne and his upstart English contemporary, H.G. Wells. Verne was avowedly no scientist, but he wanted to be scientifically plausible. In From the Earth to the Moon, 1865, Verne sends his lunar explorers off in a capsule shot out of a giant cannon. He includes pages of precise calculations in a brave attempt to prove that such a thing were possible. Brave, but ultimately mistaken. It is not possible to shoot yourself to the moon via cannon. Do not try this at home. Wells, like Lucas, was always much more interested in the workings of society and the individual than in the mechanics of science. When he got around to writing his own protagonist lunar novel, The First Man in the Moon, 1901, Wells had his scientist declare that he'd never heard of Verne's book. He proceeds to discover an anti-gravity substance called Cavorite that simply floats his capsule, with him and a visiting businessman in it, moonwards. Verne sweated the details so much that his adventures didn't get to the moon until a sequel novel. Wells wanted to ship his heroes there as fast as possible so they could explore a fanciful lunar civilization he had invented. This irked Verne to the point that he made a mocking and rather point-missing demand of Wells. I can show you gunpowder. Show me the Cavorite. When Lucas decided to make his version of outer space noisy with laser fire and screeching jets, he was establishing himself in the Wellesian tradition. This Verne-Wells split can be seen in the earliest short, silent science fiction movies, too. This time, the divide was the Atlantic rather than the Channel. Georges Méliès made a trip to the moon in 1902, shooting his explorers in a cannon. Thomas Edison made a trip to Mars in 1910, in which a scientist covers himself in anti-gravity dust and floats to the red planet. They were at odds over means, but what united Verne and Wells was a crying need to expand the landscape of the human imagination. Myths, as Lucas once observed, are invariably set in that place just over the hill. The next frontier, real enough to excite interest, but unexplored enough to be mysterious. Distant Greek islands in the classical age. The dark forest in medieval fairy tales. The Americas in the wake of Columbus. By the 20th century, with most of the planet explored, space became the last remaining place just over the hill. And one corner of space in particular fascinated authors and readers and solidified the lineage that led to Star Wars. Mars. The Mars craze spread steadily after an Italian astronomer, Giovanni Schiaparelli, famously spotted channels, canali, on the red planet in 1877. British and American newspapers, not understanding or caring much about the difference between canali and canals, loved to print large, illustrated speculative features on Martian civilization, especially after amateur astronomer Percival Lowell wrote a trilogy of nonfiction books detailing what that civilization might look like. Writers with no scientific background started to pen novels of Martian exploration. Their methods of reaching the red planet varied wildly. In Across the Zodiac, 1880, English journalist Percy Gregg sends his explorers off in an anti-gravity rocket called the Astronaut. He coined the term. Gustavus Pope, a Washington, D.C. doctor, whose previous book had tackled Shakespeare, wrote Journey to Mars in 1894. In it, an American naval lieutenant encounters Martians on a small island near the South Pole. Eventually, they take him back to their planet in an anti-gravity ethervolt car. Wells, meanwhile, confounded genres by having his Martian invaders in the 1897 classic War of the Worlds arrive via capsules shot from Martian cannons, Verne in reverse. But where Mars first met space fantasy was in a book that is the unlikely great-granddaddy of Star Wars. An English writer and son of a newspaper baron, Edwin Lester Arnold, decided to cast aside spacecraft altogether. In Lieutenant Gulliver Jones, His Vacation, 1905, he takes another fictional U.S. Navy lieutenant and packs him off to Mars on a magical Persian carpet. Arnold's Mars is surprisingly medieval. The people of Hither, indolent and soaked in a strong wine, are beset by the barbarous hordes of Thither. The Hitherites have a slave class, a king, and a beautiful princess. When the princess is taken in tribute to Thither, Jones sets off on a planet-wide journey to free her. He is an oddly unappealing protagonist, prone to long speeches, too smug to be a hero, too upright to be an anti-hero. He carves USA into the side of a mountain during his journey. Arnold seemed torn between adventure story and anti-American satire, and the novel was a flop. Dismayed, he quit writing. It would not be published in the United States until 1964. Arnold's idea of a fantasy Mars was rescued 5 years after he wrote it by an unlikely savior, a 35-year-old manager of pencil sharpener salesmen in Chicago. The pencil guy had a lot of time on his hands, a lot of stationery in the office, and a desire for greatness that wouldn't quit. He read pulp fiction magazines, and noting that most of their stories were rot, he tried his hand at one. Like Arnold's tale, it is narrated by an American officer who is magically transported to Mars, this time in the blink of an eye, by sheer willpower. No Cavorite, no carpets, just a man drawn with the suddenness of thought through the trackless immensity of space. Like Jones, the pencil guy's protagonist meets outlandish human-like characters and ape men and fights heroically for the hand of a princess. The pencil guy thought his story childish and ridiculous. He asked for it to be published under a pen name intended to telegraph his sanity, Normal Bean. His real name he thought unsuitable for an author. It was Edgar Rice Burroughs. The serial that became A Princess of Mars was first published in February 1912 in a monthly pulp magazine called The All Story. It was a runaway success. Captain John Carter, Burroughs's larger-than-life hero and fictional uncle, found a following that Gulliver Jones could only dream of. No confused satire, this. In Burroughs's book, lines of good and evil are clearly drawn. Carter is less wordy, there's not a line of dialogue in the first third of the book, and more consistently placed in peril than Jones. From chapter one, when he is attacked by, of all people, Native Americans in Arizona, Carter is beset by spears, swords, rifles, and claws. The lesser gravity of Mars, which Burroughs dubs Barsoom, gives Carter just enough of an advantage in strength to help him overcome these considerable odds. He can leap buildings in a single bound. As well as kicking the space fantasy genre into high gear, Carter has a good claim on being the first superhero. He's the progenitor of both Superman and Luke Skywalker. Burroughs bought a ranch called Tarzana in present-day L.A., quit the pencil job, and churned out three more serialized sequels, plus the story he named for his new home, Tarzan of the Apes, before Princess of Mars even made it to publication in book form. Over the rest of a productive, affluent lifetime, Burroughs would return to Barsoom in 11 more books. Barsoom is a fascinating planet, and unprecedented in its mixing of past and future concepts. It is a dying and largely barbaric world, but an atmosphere factory keeps it breathing. It has military flying machines, radium pistols, telepathy, domed cities, and medicine that makes lifespans 1,000 years long. But it also offers plenty of swordplay, courtly codes of honor, a medieval bestiary of creatures, and a succession of chieftains carrying lances on their steeds. The exotic desert setting is straight out of 1001 Nights. Barsoom's stories follow a trusty formula. Escapes, rescues, duels, and wars are the main attraction. But in between them, Burroughs reveals aspects of this curious world with the confidence of a good travel writer. Territories are clearly delineated. Green Tharks are largely barbaric nomads. The red inhabitants of Helium are rational aristocrats. In his second book, Gods of Mars, we find blonde-haired, white-skinned Barsoomians who are evil, decadent murderers, preying on the planet's inhabitants with the false promise of heaven. Burroughs was modest and careful to say he was only writing for the money. But that's an understatement. Read him today and you can easily get infected by the same powerful, pure, childlike enjoyment that enveloped the author as he wrote. Barsoom offers morally clear heroics, with as much mythological depth as you care to invest in its mysteries. The thrill of exploration and the wonderment of a world that is able to cause us to suspend our disbelief are rendered with the same spirit Lucas would later describe in his movies as effervescent giddiness. You can find this spirit in the work of artists as diverse as J.R.R. Tolkien and Stan Lee, ideal for the adolescent mindset, yes, but accessible to all and capable of greatness. Arthur Conan Doyle's epigraph to The Lost World, 1912, would explain this principle so well that it would also later grace the press materials for the original Star Wars. I have wrought my simple plan, if I give 1 hour of joy, to the boy who's half a man, or the man who's half a boy. That statement was wrong in one respect. It turned out early on that women and girls like this stuff too. Deja Thoris, John Carter's Barsoomian wife, who has his eggs, how that's possible, we don't know, except to reiterate, it's space fantasy, is hardly an empowered heroine by 21st century standards. Carter has to rescue her from implied rape dozens of times in 11 books. But the eponymous princess of the first book is a scientist, an explorer, a negotiator. Her famously bosom-filled portraits by fantasy artist Frank Frazetta in the 1960s turned her into a sexual icon, but they barely did her justice. By the standards of her day, Deja Thoris was a suffragette.
Princess Leia had a long line of antecedents, and they go back to Deja.
Burroughs published his last Barsoom stories in 1943, and the last in a similar Venus series in 1942, 8 years before he died. By then, the genre was variously known as space fantasy, space opera, planetary romance, and sword and planet, and had been taken over by Burroughs's many successors. Most memorable was his fellow Angelino, Lee Brackett, later known as the Queen of Space Opera. She burst out of nowhere in 1940 at age 25, selling an astonishing streak of 26 stories to pulp magazines in 4 years. All were set in what became known as the Brackett solar system. Her conception of each planet was fairly derivative. Her Mars and Venus looked a lot like Burroughs's, but where Brackett excelled was in describing the interplanetary conflict between them. The scope had expanded, from Mars wars to solar wars. Brackett's scope was expanding too, and she started working on Hollywood screenplays such as The Big Sleep. She was unable to bring her two careers together until 1978, when she was named the writer of the first draft of The Empire Strikes Back. Brackett's husband, Edmund Hamilton, would also contribute to Star Wars, albeit in a more nebulous fashion. His 1933 story in the pulp magazine Weird Tales, Kaldar, Planet of Antares, contains this groundbreaking description of a weapon wielded by its hero, a saber made of light. The sword seemed at first glance a simple long rapier of metal, but he found that when his grip tightened on the hilt, it pressed a catch which released a terrific force stored in the hilt into the blade, making it shine with light. When anything was touched by this shining blade, he found, the force of the blade annihilated it instantly. He learned that the weapon was called a light sword. Hamilton's story was reprinted in paperback in 1965, 8 years before a young filmmaker named George Lucas would begin to devour every pulp science fiction story he could get his hands on. Alongside Burroughs, The pulp magazines that published Hamilton, Brackett, and their ilk were in many ways the other grandparents of Star Wars. Two of the most important stories in the prehistory of the franchise both appeared in the August 1928 issue of Amazing Stories. The cover showed a man with a jetpack. He was the star of Skylark of Space, a story written by E.E. Doc Smith, a food chemist